You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
A Journey, My Political Life, is the title of Tony Blair's memoirs, which were published this fall. It's a 700-page political reflection by the former British Prime Minister who infamously stood shoulder to shoulder with George W. Bush. Joining us in studio to help us decipher this text is activist and author Derek O'Keefe. Derek is also the co-chair of StopWar.ca Vancouver. Hello, Derek.
Good morning.
What kind of expectations did you have for Tony Blair's memoirs?
Well, to be very honest, I did not have great expectations. It's been very clear in the two or three years that he's been out of office that he has, as he says, no regrets about the war in Iraq. And I think the only way, really, that his memoirs could have been looked at with any great anticipation by people around the world if it was some of those 700 pages was devoted to a confessional about his errors, not just in Iraq, but also the disaster that he's made of the some of the traditions of the Labour Party and the Labour movement in Britain. So not big expectations going in, to be honest, but curious as to how he would justify himself and how he would tell the story.
And so what did you think of the book?
I was very surprised by one aspect of it, which was the tone. And maybe it's befitting our PR marketing age, where he tries to adopt a very chatty, sort of populist tone, as if the book was not edited very heavily. Now, this might have been partly to get him to his 700 pages, but I found it curious that the way that he expressed himself, just to give one, oftentimes it was vulgar. I don't know if he was going for a populist touch here or what, but he, for instance, he talks about how he likes people with balls, and he likes politicians with balls. And even one of the women he admires in his circle, I think it was his booking secretary, he admires her because if she'll squeeze the balls of people to get her way and to push them around. So there's this kind of strange, unguarded machismo that is thrown into the book. So I was surprised at that. And in some ways, there's he may be attempting to adopt a candid tone. And there's only one or two surprises, though. So there's more. The tone was more surprising than the content. For instance, he sort of offhandedly admits that he had a bit of a drinking problem while he was in 10 Downing Street. He talks about how after a little while, he needed a stiff whiskey or gin and tonic before dinner, a couple glasses of wine, or even half a bottle with it. Not excessive. I had a limit, but I was aware that it had become a prop. So he just sort of throws this off. And that sentence or that little paragraph I was surprised at. So in a way, you could say that he had become drunk with power, had drunk with his association with George Bush and the war in Iraq. So that was an interesting contrast there to the dry drunk of George Bush. But the majority of the contents didn't surprise me. It was sort of typical self-justification on Iraq and other foreign policy things, and also just his score settling on the whole internal feud with Gordon Brown and the long battle within the Labour Party that he ultimately won, much to the long-term harm of the Labour Party itself.
Well, let's stick with that, the war in Iraq, for a little bit. What does he have to say about that war?
Well, he apologizes for not apologizing. He says, you know, a lot of friends who disagree with me about the war think I'm being obstinate, but I ask them to keep an open mind. So he asks people who are upset that he's not apologizing or regretful to keep an open mind. And he basically just repeats the Bush mantra, the mantra of other really recalcitrant defenders of the war, that the world is a better place without Saddam Hussein. He also offers some crocodile tears to the war dead, and it seems as though he's speaking primarily to the dead in the UK. I don't know what he feels about the 100,000 of Iraqis, but he says the exact quote, something to the effect that I'm greatly disappointed at the randomness of the selection of who had to suffer, who had to die for this great war. And he talks about how the tears have been many. So he says he has shed tears for the victims, but given the rest of his self-justification and his rationalizing this war that has just claimed so many lives and has led to such disaster in Iraq, you really have to say that these are crocodile tears. And an aspect of the crocodile tears went along with the marketing of the book as well. He made quite a show of announcing that the proceeds of the book would go to the Legion, specifically to aid the maimed and injured from Iraq and Afghanistan. So maybe someone thought that this would be spun as a humanitarian gesture. To me, it's almost like adding insult to injury. That he will transfer a small amount of his great fortune now to the injured from these wars that he was part of causing. It seems to me quite sick. If he were to give all his wealth away to the war injured, that would be one thing. But the proceeds of the book are a small fraction of his income when he comes to Canada and the United States to give a talk. He's in the tens of thousands, if not $100,000 speaking fee range. So this is a multi-millionaire and plans to live the rest of his life jet-setting and rubbing shoulders with the rich and powerful.
Well, perhaps it would take real balls to give away all your money.
Yeah, well, there you go.
The reason Blair got himself entangled in the Iraq War was he wanted to cultivate a special relationship with the United States. What does he say about the Americans?
Well, the book is very much addressed to Americans. I was stunned that the entire introduction is devoted to telling of his relationships with three American presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and then Obama, even though he wasn't in power. When Obama came into office, he felt the need to talk about how he knew Obama and weigh in on that. He talks about essentially the entire introduction of the book is a tribute to American exceptionalism, this unique and noble role that the United States has to play in the world. And it's clear that, even though he was the top political dog in Britain,